Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of WrestleNomics Radio. I'm Brandon Thurston, broadcasting live and on demand from New York, New York. And today I'm joined by Chris Scullo, who is, he's not to my immediate south. He's actually to my northwest. And how's the snow? How's
the it's Buffalo? A lot. So where I live, I have got over 4 feet. We're done, though. Yes, the snow last night was done, but Orchard Park, where the Buffalo Bills play, and we're supposed to play today, 77 inches. And that was actually before the snow last night, so it was probably more than that.
You, in fact, were not even supposed to join us today for WrestleNomics Radio. You're supposed to be at the Bills game.
Yep. I was supposed to be at the Bills
game. In Orchard Park. But that Bills game in Orchard Park is no longer taking place. It is taking place at the home of WrestleMania 23, yep. Ford Field in Detroit. Is it like officially Detroit, or is it one of those suburbs? Anyway, why do you think they canceled the Bills game?
Well, Orchard Park did get hit the worst, and I think they just the amount of time and crews to get the football field ready for Sunday. I mean, it's still like war zone out there. Like people are still trying to like. I guess I shouldn't use that term, but it's still like you see emergency service trucks and all that trying to.
Yeah, so I moved my flight. To leave a day earlier, and if I hadn't done that, I would not have made it here for sure. I haven't looked at the airport arrivals yet or departures to see if planes are actually moving in and out of Buffalo Airport. But I parked in long term parking at the airport. I'm really curious to see what my situation is going to be like when I return home, assuming I'm able to return home on Monday.
When do you come home tomorrow?
Afternoon.
So you might get lucky because we're supposed to get like 40 degrees to melt a little bit of that snow tomorrow afternoon. So
good. I meant to ask you this off air, but did you watch Full Gear?
I have watched bits and parts of it. I have not watched all of it. Yes.
Okay.
When you're snowed in with your wife, you kind of got to compromise.
I watched all of Full Gear as well as Rampage, as well as a lot of AEW Dark. So we'll talk about all that today. And I'm broadcasting from an office building in New York City with a lot of help from NJ who will join us later to argue with me perhaps about the oncoming supposed bubble bursting of live sports rights fees. But we'll discuss that later once we get all through all this AEW discussion. I don't know if there'll be a ton of WWE discussion on this program, but we usually do pretty good ratings when there's AEW discussion anyhow. If people want to participate today, they could participate by sending in a super chat, which is the button that you see somewhere in your YouTube interface as we bring the slides up here. We do have a few slides to show today. So we do have some information about pay-per-view buys, which is what we have on the screen here for people watching on YouTube. I have some updated estimates of the most recent pay-per-views, which are slightly different numbers than what I've reported in the past for these most recent pay-per-views, which is normally the case. They change and they get finalized to, I guess, more final numbers. Also, late buys come in. So we get sort of more specific ideas of what these pay-per-views sold. So Double or Nothing, 165,000. Earlier, I'd reported 155,000, so that's 10,000 higher. Forbidden Door, 140, up from 127. All Out, 140, which is up from 139, because I'd been using a median of two numbers on either side of that. In the post-pay-per-view press conference, or scrum, Tony Khan did give us an idea of what the pay-per-view buys were looking like, in his view. Do you have that quote handy, Gullo?
Yeah, so this is what Tony Khan said. Looks very positive off pre-show buys. During the pay-per-view, I wasn't tracking the buys as much, but it looks very similar to the recent pay-per-views. They've been very stable lately in a good range. Brandon, you say to him, 140. Tony says, yeah, I mean, that's probably not far off. That was the preliminary buys. It could be higher, it could be lower. I definitely think similar to the other shows this year, which is a really good number. I'd say the last two shows were in the range of about 140,000, and I think this could be there or better.
Okay. So 140 would be down year over year from 155 for full gear last year. I bring that up because that's been a talking point in the past that they've continued to that Tony Khan has just brought up that the given pay-per-view was continuing to be higher than the one before it. And we're seeing a plateauing of that. And this is the first pay-per-view, presumably, after the permanent exit of CM Punk. And it's something we brought up before, is that the five best-selling pay-per-views in AEW's history are the five pay-per-views that CM Punk appeared on for AEW. I guess now we'd say All Out and Forbidden Door appear to be roughly tied. But yeah, it's if we plug in 140,000 pay-per-view buys worldwide, I can get to a gross of about 4.5 million net revenue for AEW. When you put in a $1 million gate and the venue merchandise, which would be somewhere between $100,000 and $200,000, if you assume about $15 per head off of the paid attendance that they probably had, based on WrestleTix. The latest WrestleTix number that I've seen is 11,842. I generally assume events are about 93% paid, so that would bring us down to like 11,000 paid, and then you just calculate 15 per head off of that. Anyway, you get to about $4.5 million in net revenue after what I estimate are splits with the various pay-per-view carriers. By the way, there was some YouTube distribution on pay-per-view in some markets here, which is a first for AEW. But $4.5 million would be within the range of All Out, would be within the range of Forbidden Door, would probably be lower than Double or Nothing, would be within the range of Revolution. So there's that. Let's see here. What else do we have? So I went to Rampage as well as Full Gear. There's a lot of Okayama. In fact, I was convinced to go to Rampage because I figured it might be a once in a lifetime experience to actually see one of the five pillars, I guess. Then I may never get another chance, and Shohei Baba would not look favorably upon me if I passed up on this opportunity to see Jun Akiyama live in person. He's having a tag match with Konosuke Takeshita versus Eddie Kingston and Ortiz. Of course, they set up the match after the show went off the air, I believe, a singles match on the pre-show between Eddie Kingston and Jun Akiyama. So I will note, though, that I went to the venue. This is Prudential Center in Newark, New Jersey, of course. And as I was entering the building near one of the main entrances, they have these wonderful, even the entrances are corporately sponsored at the Prudential Center. Did you know that? There's an M&M entrance, like Wrigley's Mars M&M, and then I think there's a Citizens Bank entrance or something like that. Is that a conflict with Prudential? Anyway, anyways, as I was going into the one entrance for, this is for Rampage now, I overheard a group of two people go up to security and say, "Hey, we're seat fillers. We're looking for what entrance we should go in." So I would imagine they were not the only two who were participating in that event as seat fillers. So I just overheard that. So that was apparently happening.
Have they used just regular people seat fillers before? Because I know of extra talent indie wrestlers that have been seat fillers for them.
For AEW?
I've never heard of like WWE does, where you just get an email and you're not involved in the wrestling business. Who knows? They could have been indie wrestlers. Who knows this?
I want to say one of these people might have been wearing an indie wrestling branded shirt, but I don't know. I don't clearly remember. But in any case, I'm aware of other situations, and apparently you are too, all aware there have been seat fillers used at AEW events. And this event, I can see the need for seat fillers at this event. So Full Gear, as we just mentioned, had something in excess of 11,000 tickets distributed. This event for the Rampage taping, according to WrestleTix, had 6,000 tickets distributed. So So this venue was like half full. It was pretty sparse, especially like considering the nature of what these solo Rampage tapings are, where it's the core content, if you will, like the prime piece of content is at 10 o'clock Eastern. So particularly when you're not doing this on the West Coast, maybe it's easier. Maybe it's smoother on the West Coast. But doing this at 10 o'clock, where it sort of encourages people to show up late if they're going to show up at all. In this case, where there's a lot of combo ticket sales happening, where they were trying to sell tickets with Rampage tickets with full gear tickets. So anyway, there's a lot of 2 hours of AEW Dark is what I sat through here. There were also some. Did you know? As we all know, there is AEW merchandise available inside the venue. Anyone who has attended an AEW event knows that there's AEW merchandise available inside the venue. Now, I can report as well with my boots on the ground that there was AEW merchandise available outside the venue, which is, I don't think, normal, as there were some individuals offering AEW t-shirts that I'm not sure were official AEW t-shirts.
It's not like WWE, where WWE also has the outside stand. Okay, no.
No, they didn't have a big fancy van. They were just standing with a pile of shirts next to them. They accepted cash as well as Venmo. They accept Venmo. They were there before the event as well as after the event. In fact, after the event, they were offering 50% off on their merchandise. So great deal.
I don't think I've ever seen that actually at a wrestling show.
You've never seen bootleggers at a wrestling show?
Maybe not in years. Not in years. I've seen concerts and Bills. Oh my God, the Buffalo Bill shirts. I don't think it's probably been since the Attitude Era that I've probably seen that. I'm trying to remember. Like, people actually selling wrestling t-shirts outside? Bootleggers? I haven't seen it in a long time.
Well, as a co-host of Wrestling, I'm sure you're aware that, do you know, like, we get that big, maybe this will ring a bell, you know, we get that big long list sometimes in like the spring, just before WrestleMania, of WWE's full live touring schedule.
Yeah,
that's because they file a lawsuit, sort of a preemptive lawsuit against John Doe's, so that local law enforcement can enforce,
yeah,
and try to stop people illegally selling merchandise outside the venues. That was happening at AEW. I think that was happening at Full Gear too, I want to say. It was interesting that there were, that Dasha was doing like an 8 second or 5 second countdown before each AEW Dark match to sort of like, I imagine that's like in reaction to like a lack of attention maybe that they found sometimes to try to get people's attention focused in on the ring.
I feel like Justin Roberts has done that too. At times, yeah. Dark. Yeah.
It definitely feels like a remedy, or you know, not enough people were paying attention sometimes, and they had to do.
Hey, a big part of a ring announcer's job is to keep the crowd hyped, man. Keep them energetic. I can tell you from experience, you know. So, you know, she might have even done it on her own recognition, looking at the energy of the crowd. So,
yeah. I had a lot of thoughts as I was sitting there watching AEW Dark about the Ring of Honor interaction, and I would argue dilution of the AEW brand and of AEW talent. And there was quite a bit of discussion on the media scrum, which people can find on AEW's official YouTube channel, as well as from members of the media who were there. I'll say that Will Nightingale was more over than her push. She was very over to a crowd that was not well populated. It was a very different atmosphere from night one compared to night two. But I couldn't help but notice sitting there watching all these matches for AEW Dark with a crowd that was, you know, kind of into it and kind of waiting for Rampage. They weren't super hot for Rampage either. But it felt like there's, over time in AEW, it's increasingly become the case that there's a lot of talent, you know, more talent this month than last month or this quarter than last quarter. And AEW only has a finite amount of TV time. Yeah, they have Dark, but I don't think Dark is reaching nearly as many. It's definitely not reaching nearly as many people as Dynamite is, and to a lesser extent, rampages. And I think there's only a finite appetite that they're going to be able to achieve there, let's say 3 hours. And the appetite that people have for rampage is diminishing based on the diminishing ratings of rampage. And you can have all this ancillary extra stuff on YouTube, AW Dark, that's fine. A very diminished population of people, a very diminished audience is going to be willing to consume that stuff. Point is, of all this is to say, this is the space and time that you have to get people over, to get talent over. While your talent pool is growing. So basically, I'm saying I think they have too much talent. And I think they're left with the amount of talent that they have now. They're sort of left with two bad alternatives. And one is to sort of more evenly distribute that talent over their core hours of, say, Dynamite and Rampage, and to just sort of share the time with everybody more, give everybody more equal time, which gets everyone over less because then everyone has less time to get over. Or they could not do that and just use select talent more. I think this is probably the better of two bad alternatives. But just to use select people more, focus on those people, get those people over more strongly. But then that kind of wastes the money that you're spending on that talent, the travel expense that you're spending on that talent. You're probably risking the morale and goodwill of the people who are not getting used. And for the talent themselves, it's probably not the best way to have them spend their career and to have them develop as talent. And I think that the dilution of that, it's resulting in lower TV ratings, lower ticket sales, especially for Rampage. And I think arguably lower TV ratings and ticket sales for Dynamite. And ultimately, I suppose, lower pay-per-view buys as well. We've talked about, and I think we talked about on Thursday for subscribers in the podcast that we did as soon as I got out of Grand Central, about it's becoming pretty clear that AEW's attendance is waning, especially when you look at it in what I think is the fairest way to look at it, by looking at it market to market, event type to event type. By that, I mean, let's look at the Dynamite ticket sales for a given town compared to the last time they were there. And yeah, some of this is comparing a first time in the market to the second time or the third time they've been in the market. And perhaps there's some natural diminishing returns from that. But some of it, I think, is related to, well, the lack of CM Punk, who I think, I believe we've demonstrated here, was clearly their strongest individual talent draw. Yes, CM Punk is a draw. And other absences too. I mean, they've finally got Kenny Omega and Young Bucks back. But and I think there's just a sort of malaise over the product, certainly going into this weekend, that has contributed to lower Rampage TV ratings, most prominently, lower ticket sales, and we did not see a strong Dynamite rating this past Wednesday. A 0.28 in the demo, which was their lowest since June in the regular time slot. So yeah, this was kind of a low energy dark taping, but it's to see people like Zach Layton, who had like a short squash match, and this is someone who is like a former reality TV star who may have potential, but to whatever extent he has potential, I think it's hardly going to be developed in these sort of short matches that they're having in front of crowds that are not super hot, having matches with sort of the an indie enhancement talent who's not more known than they are, who may not be they may have a fine match and may serve the purpose that you want to achieve here. We want to have a 3-minute match where Zach Layton squashes somebody, fine match. Does it develop him to whatever extent he's going to be developed? Is that the best situation for him? I would argue not.
I mean, to your point, Brandon, I thought when Elevation was announced, right, that it was going to be different, that it was going to be 3 to 4 matches before Dynamite that had, mid-card talent versus mid-card talent, maybe a top talent versus competitive matches. You know what I mean? Not just enhancement talent matches against, you know, an AEW star. And just we haven't really seen that since, like, the first couple weeks. I really think they should pivot that way. Like, you just give the crowd 3 to 4 matches, so you don't really burn them out by the time they get to Rampage, too. Give them 3 to 4 competitive Dark Elevation matches, give them Dynamite, then give them Rampage. And I think it would be a better fan experience. And then any of the enhancement tail matches, you could put those on the dark tapings in Orlando.
I think in the media scrum, Will Washington from Fightful and Tony had an interesting discussion about... I could see Tony getting ready to say it before he said it about... Will was asking about if the number of pay-per-views that are being done between AEW and Ring of Honor is the right number, and if that's the same number that they're going to do, let's say next year, essentially is what he was asking. And Tony wanted to clarify, when you say you mean Tony Khan, not AEW and Ring of Honor, because Tony apparently views AEW and Ring of Honor as more separate entities than I think the average person does. It's a way that he views the two brands as separate that I don't think the market views the two brands as separate. And I think that difference is allowing him to justify what I think is ultimately diluting the AEW brand and encouraging him to bring in more and more talent that have no additional time to get over. So I think that's something that's, along with the loss of CM Punk, is contributing to a malaise in AEW. So all that said, I think this going into this pay-per-view, this is a big moment to step up to the plate. And if you have a bad pay-per-view here, that's going to be another layer of malaise on the product. But I don't think that's what we had here. Cagematch.net, last I looked, as of late last night at like 3 a.m. Sorry, everybody, by the way, we're starting late here. I got back to where I was staying with family at like 3 a.m. Going into this pay-per-view, I think it was really important that they had a great show. And most AEW pay-per-views have been well-received, at least if you look at the Cage Match ratings. I think Cage Match has started to put a block on... I don't know if you can rate them, but you definitely can't look at the event rating immediately after the show starts or immediately after the show ends. So if I'm going to the Full Gear page... Oh, we do have an 8.68 as I sit here right now. So how does that compare? Let's see here. But yeah, I think it was really important that AEW has a home run show. The first two matches were really good. The cage match and the six-man tag match. I have to say that the Jade Cargill and Nyla Rose match just... As that match was going to the ring, and after the six-man tag, which was a really excellent match, and the crowd was super hot for the Elite's first match in months, people got up and a lot of people were filing up the stairs and into the concourse. So there was just a lot less attention paid on that match. Other things that I think were prominent to point out when. The tag match between Jeff Jarrett teaming with Jay Lethal against Sting and Darby Allin. Jeff Jarrett's music hit. What's the name of his song?
My World.
Yes. And somebody behind me, I was sitting with a lot of media, so I'm not sure who said it. Somebody behind me says, I wrote it down. This song sucks. It makes me think of TNA, and I don't want to think about TNA, which I thought was an apt way to point to how Jeff Jarrett's presence affects the AEW brand, in that it's supposed to be, you know, AEW is supposed to be the strong alternative in the face of a lot of things that have tried to be a strong alternative and haven't been the strong alternative that fans have wanted from a non-WWE product that is high profile. And his presence there makes people think of the disappointment that's associated with TNA. Another thing that came to mind, sitting and watching the press scrum, especially at the moment where he was sitting between Anthony Bowens and Max Caster. It seems like Tony has like a deep emotional investment in talent. And I think I would speculate that he gets very connected to talent and at least some people he can sense that he feels really proud of them, right? As they're sitting there and they're doing well and they're getting very over and they're apparently selling a ton of merchandise. And you can see sort of an emotion on his face that he's worked hard with them and tried to get them over and it's worked out. And I imagine that he's grown a lot of emotional attachment and investment into a lot of talent. And I'm guessing that has resulted in things like having a show that's a 4-hour show that has a lot of great matches and a lot of great talent on it, but it's just a lot to digest and it's a lot to ask of the viewer. And there's just a lot of talent in AEW that I think is ultimately to the detriment of the greater good of the talent in general. Any thoughts or questions or things to dig into on all these free-willing things that you said, Gullo? You're frozen in. Oh, there you go.
Yeah. What would you? So you kind of mentioned a little bit the interest of the match. How was the crowd from start to bottom as far as energy? Do you think they got burnt out? I mean, it was a lot of matches. It still ended late. Do you think?
Yeah, crowd was super hot for the beginning of it. I would say the crowd was not the crowd through AEW Dark on Friday night was not great. Through Rampage, they were better. Again, you got like a 12,000 seat venue or whatever it is that was only half full. Following night, they had a full venue. And I imagine coming across on television, Alan Forel from Alan Quinan from the Torch mentioned that and I haven't seen any of this on the telecast myself, but he mentioned that he felt that they AEW must be miking the audience differently. And I did notice, and right in front of where they had us seated in sort of media row, there were these three things, and I took pictures of them and tweeted them. These things that I imagine are microphones that were not present. I look back at my pictures that I'd taken because I took a bunch of pictures on Friday night and sent them to WrestleTix. So I looked at those pictures and I couldn't find these microphone looking objects anywhere in my Friday night pictures. But there these objects were on Saturday night. So I think they are miking the Saturday or miking the pay per view differently than they mic'd Rampage, which I'm guessing is a specific way that they mic the crowd for pay-per-view. I don't know why they do that. I you would think they would want it. You would think that that's not a huge added expense to add some audio equipment and production, but maybe they just want to be able to manage, the chance that end up on TV. I don't know. I thought the crowd was not that invested in the Nyla Rose match and Nyla Rose and Jade Cargill match. A ton of heat for the first two. The crowd for the main event was a little tired too, but MJF and Moxley were very over. Do you have the quote from Tony Khan? I think he revealed a number for pay per view buys for Ring of Honor, which is at least new to me. Which was in the course of his discussion with Lil Washington about the Ring of Honor, the pay-per-view load for Ring of Honor and AEW, and the semantics of Ring of Honor and AEW. You have that quote?
Yeah, well, I have this specifically on the Ring of Honor pay-per-view buys. It would probably be 25% or so what you get from an AEW pay-per-view, or less than 25% from an AEW pay-per-view. Say a number like 35,000 buys at the price point for Ring of Honor, which is also a lower price point. So this was, as you said, this was in the middle of a whole big thing about Ring of Honor kind of being separate from AEW, and it was there was a lot to take there. But we saw this here about the pay-per-view buys, 35,000.
Yeah, so that sounds like something that's in the realm of a real number that he's referring to there, which would be about a quarter of what these AEW pay-per-views are doing. He gave people the impression that Full Gear did is going to end up measuring something around 140,000. I would be surprised a little lower than 140,000. I definitely would have predicted lower. I would have expected lower just based on the lack of CM Punk, based on the weakening that I'm starting to see in other areas, including attendance and TV ratings. So, yeah, I think, and anyway, Ring of Honor doing about a quarter of AEW pay-per-view buys, that sounds right, I guess. That sounds realistic. And it also sounds, as Tony has said, better than what Ring of Honor had been doing pretty much at any point in its history. So anyway, we had one other thing to do here. So in the press conference, Denise Salcedo asked him essentially if, so there's a six-man tag best of seven that's been set up now between the Elite and Death Triangle. Seven matches. They announced dates for them. We have the slide. We can put it on the screen. There it is. It's March 1st, or not March 1st, match one, November 19th, which already happened. That was the pay-per-view. Match two is in Chicago at Wintrust. Match three is in Indianapolis, November 30th. The next one is December 14th in Garland. The next one is December 21st in San Antonio. The next one is December 28th in Denver, Colorado. And then they skip a week. And then the seventh match, if necessary, which I'm sure it will be, is in Los Angeles on January 11th. So what week are they skipping over there between December 28th? Or what day are they skipping over there between December 28th and January 11th? What is the Wednesday?
January 4th, we're at Wrestle Kingdom, and AEW's in Seattle.
Yes, and it was announced this morning on the New Japan show. I believe there's a New Japan Stardom show that happened to What Is Us this morning. And they announced a Kenny Omega versus Will Ospreay match that will happen at Wrestle Kingdom. So anyway, he was asked in the press conference, Tony was, before New Japan had announced this, obviously, about whether, basically whether they were going to appear, Kenny Omega was going to appear on Wrestle Kingdom. And he was coy about it, probably knowing that this announcement was coming and not wanting to spoil New Japan's announcement. So there's that.
All right. Before we get to sports rights talk, let's do some super chats if that's okay with you.
Fine.
All right. So main event Mike here, pull him up, says, great questions last night on the scrum and the pre-show call, Brandon. So, yes, you got some good questions at the
main scrum.
Thank you, main event Mike.
Thank you, guys. So I think there's the media scrum, I thought, was a pretty good media scrum. I hesitate to say too much about wrestling media in general because I'm involved, I guess. But I thought there were a lot of good questions. And you can look back at other media scrums and media calls and say, well, there's a lot of softball and careful questions being asked. But I thought this was a pretty good one in terms of thoughtful and newsworthy questions being asked.
Has All Out changed the dynamic of these to maybe a more journalistic approach?
I thought the All Out press conference was fine too, but maybe. And maybe just, I think some of the criticism of the media's conduct in these situations is probably in the air and maybe causing people to reflect too. But it helps to have, you know, to have John Pollock there. I thought John Pollock asked a few really good questions. There's probably more post wrestling praise to come later in this podcast, but so we should talk a little bit maybe later about our experience at the post wrestling 5th anniversary live event. But just like I'm just astounded by like how did he get that out of his brain? I could never have gotten that kind of question out of my brain. So I thought there were some good questions asked. I'm not saying it was perfect, but it was the most satisfied I think I've felt with the media's contribution in those situations.
And we have another super chat here from Tim B. Has combo ticketing backfired for AEW?
I don't know. Like, would it have been any different? I think they've. So what they've done is they've tried to. I believe there were situations on previous pay-per-view weekends where they've done, you know, because it makes sense financially to run a Rampage on Friday, a pay-per-view on Saturday or Sunday in the same venue, so you don't have to load in and load out, and you sell some more tickets and you sell some more merchandise. So it makes sense to do that. The problem is they've ended up with weekends where, yeah, the pay-per-view is basically sold out, but the Rampage is doesn't do nearly as well. To try to resolve that, as Tim B is pointing out here, they've tried to tie those two tickets together, so you have to buy both tickets. So I believe what happened on Friday in particular is that there were a lot of tickets that were sold for this event. They sold them, and I think a lot of people did not show up. I think there's a healthy chunk of that audience on Friday night that just didn't show up for the tickets that they paid for. So AEW's getting their money. They're not getting, I don't know if they applied some other strategy that they would get a more energy and more energized crowd that would be like, it would help make the show great. But they're getting the money out of it at least. So they're getting more revenue this way and probably a similar atmosphere. The answer ultimately as to all Russ Lama's questions is just create an even more compelling product and you'll sell even more tickets.
Delmar Abdi had any potential theories of why AEW dropped to 818,000?
Not really. I mean, I think people. I've noticed if you go back, I think you'd find that some of these go home shows end up not performing particularly well. I don't know if there's any reason there, but it's a disappointing rating, and I think it's reflective of some waning interest in AEW. I mean, it's not a huge drop yet, and if they consistently delivered these numbers, that would be a lot more concerning. Dynamite seems to be benefiting from a post pay-per-view bump. Usually, we'll see if that continues on Wednesday. It surprises people, and I think about whether or not I should do this more, but I don't try to apply narratives that I hear a lot of other people try to apply to a week of TV ratings. I think there are narratives we can apply to months of TV ratings and quarters of TV ratings and certainly years of TV ratings. We talked on Thursday about how I can clearly see NXT improving its TV viewership. No, it's not nearly what Dynamite is and certainly not nearly what Raw and SmackDown are, but there's a real truthful narrative that you can apply to the NXT TV ratings. There's a truthful narrative that you can apply to Rampage declining TV ratings. We need more pieces of the story to apply a more meaningful narrative to the Dynamite rating. But this is not a good piece of that story. This 818,000 viewers on Wednesday.
All right. I think we are all caught up with Super Chats. You can still enter some Super Chats on the YouTube page, but your question with the little dollar sign right under it. Put any amount that you think is fit for the question. And we thank all of you for your Super Chats today and previously as well. All right, so time to talk some sports rights with MJ from NJ.
We'll set this up first with I asked two questions, I think, on the press conference, and I asked about pay-per-view buys, and then later I asked him this question, which we'll do our best to set up now.
I wonder if you could tell us what your perspective is of just the broader live sports rights market in the future. If there's a recession on the horizon, there's some anxiety about whether the cable industry will stay strong. WBD, your partner, is talking about cost cutting frequently. So I imagine that you have a pretty positive outlook on it. It's so important to AEW's future financially. So just wondering what your thoughts are on the live sports rights market.
Well, I've always been able to take a long view on AEW content. We have a lot of resources as a family, and it's a family business. So AEW was able to launch with a good upfront investment and then build big revenue very quickly. And now we have really strong revenue streams that have allowed us to probably, like I said, take the long view of how things play out in 2023, 2024. And I feel like the most important thing for AEW is that we have a really strong media partner with Warner Brothers Discovery. And that partnership has only gotten stronger as the merger happened. And Warner Brothers Discovery has given us more responsibility, more opportunities at additional content. And I think it's going to be good. I mean, not only have we probably got more opportunities to get more content in the WBD pipeline, but also we've had more opportunities to have interconnectivity and integrations with their shows and things that are important to them. So I think we've become an important player. And, you know, like you alluded to, it's been a challenging time for some media properties. But I think for AEW, by having strong year-over-year ratings, where we are up year-over-year, and, you know, for the entire year, and it's also been a positive quarter for Q4, the pay-per-view buys have been really strong. So I think for AEW, while it is probably for some companies that haven't had the kind of success that AEW has enjoyed in 2022, I could see why it would be a concerning market for us. I'm actually really optimistic about it, but that is a good question.
Okay. So basically what I got from his answer is that he has he's always been able to take a long view of sports rights market. They've made an investment with Shad Khan. And then he went on to talk about how strong that relationship is between WBD and AEW, and that's only going to get stronger. And he kind of made a basic case for AEW continuing to be a valuable TV rights property, which is, he pointed out, year-over-year increases in TV ratings. So I don't know if he actually got to what I was hoping he would get to is, like, why do you think that TV rights will continue to be as valuable in general going forward? So I suppose now to participate in some discussion with us about this topic is our friend MJ from who I will change my microphone setting now so that he can also participate here. So anyway, Hi, MJ for MJ. First of all, thank you for helping WrestleNomics have a place to record, so I did not have to record just outside Grand Central Terminal as I did on Thursday.
And we're sitting pretty close to each other right now, so if we're looking at each other, the audience knows why.
Yes.
I'm looking for a Nick Khan-esque.
I was looking for a lecture on how the media business works. Yeah, I guess so.
Well, you know, I don't know what Tony and the family business's long-range plan is, but I think it will continue to be a valuable property. And I think it's starting from a place where its current value is considerably lower than the competitor in its industry. So therefore, it looks like a value proposition. And I think that's going to prove beneficial and fruitful for AEW going forward in a way that some of the more mature sports properties and maybe oversaturated sports properties may not.
One of the things I kind of thought about bringing up, but I didn't bring up in the question, is that you've got basically every TV rights deal for sports that I'm aware of. And Gullo and I have talked about some of the most recent ones. Conference USA, right?
Not a huge increase, but an increase.
What was it, though? Except, what was it, 40%?
You remember?
In any case,
I think it was around there.
In any case, it got a raise. Formula One got a big raise.
Big 12 got a big raise after, and they're losing Texas and Oklahoma. It was a huge, yeah.
Right.
When I think about those, I mean, that to me, Chris, is the potential oversaturation of throwing all this money at college football conferences, the NCAA basketball. At some point, when does it hit a ceiling? And right now, they're all getting renewals. It's coming at an advantageous time for them, as we kind of now are heading into a rising interest rate environment, which will kind of stretch some of these companies that are already not profitable. You think about some of these streaming endeavors, they were loss leaders. And the idea was that the loss leader will long-term play out to be something that can drive other core businesses, or in fact, just be profitable on its own. And I think now, as we see some of these, the conferences you mentioned, some of the other sports leagues, whether it's the MLS or lacrosse or the new Golf Live League, at some point, is it worth them spending more and more money? Not that they will not spend money. And so maybe when I say the bubble will burst, I'm not referring to like a complete collapse. It's not going to look like the crypto market. It might not look like the housing market that we remember from a decade ago. But it can certainly plateau. And then you can start to see chips fall. And whether or not the next renewal go around, that's where you see declines. As soon as you see that negative on the comparison to the prior year, I think that's when you start to say, okay, this has peaked. You got to keep in mind, the last decade, there's been a lot of very cheap money to throw at all these properties because it was the only way to retain eyeballs. And I look at that and say, okay, I think that is a trend that has to reverse as it's going to across the rest of the economy.
And when you say cheap money, what does that mean?
So we've lived in they call it ZERP. And this is not financial advice, it's not ZERP. Investment advice. ZERP, zero interest rate environment. Basically, interest rates have been extremely low, almost near zero. We are now hearing, and perhaps people that are listening to this have heard in more traditional news, about rising interest rates. And they're doing this to combat inflation and what that might mean for the economy. Different than a recession, we're just seeing the cost to borrow. If I want to borrow money from you, Brandon, you're going to charge me a little big, a percentage. Well, if it was zero or less than one, I'd probably keep coming back to you for more. If it's 5, 6, 7%, and we have not come close to that yet, I think that's going to change the way that a lot of these companies, technology companies, and these kind of growth at all cost companies approach the future. And I think that's a lot of the streamers right now.
And like average people would see these interest rate changes in their mortgages. If they bought a house today, they would be buying with a higher interest rate than in previous years.
Yeah, that's a great way to think about it. If you were
going or a car loan,
exactly.
And like how does that change? This is particularly affecting networks, right? The networks that are paying. The sports rights companies like WWE, like AEW, like the NFL,
They
just don't have. It's more expensive for them to take out loans, though. But these are some pretty rich companies, though. I would think they're still nonetheless borrowing a lot of money.
They're borrowing a lot of money. If you think about the equity markets, where they can often raise money, so not debt. Obviously, we're not in a great market environment that we were over the last few years, when you would be able to issue more stock and generate money that way, generate equity that way, cash. And some of these companies, frankly, don't do as well as I think a lot of the public think. If you look at Amazon, for example, AWS carries Amazon. They're not as profitable on e-commerce. Amazon Prime is a loss leader, and the more that they go after big properties like the NFL, It could continue to be a loss leader. And what is the ultimate path to profitability? Does a company like Apple and Amazon want to dip into the profitable areas of their business to go chase this, what I call being new cable? We're going to have all the things that people keep cable for, like sports and must-see events. And then, you know, what are they going to do? Raise prices to the point where it's no longer what the consumer can keep up with? And I think that's where we're going to hit a crossroads at some point in the future. And I'm just looking at it as maybe a bit of a contrarian, that if I'm an investor, do I want to saturate or go into the existing businesses that are really good and say, you know what, those are really profitable, but go ahead and lose all this other money and go chase the white rabbit, if you will, on streaming?
And in the case of Apple, that's... they sell iPhones, for example, and they have a very powerful business doing that. In the case of Amazon, it's their retail business and web services. Am I getting that right?
I would say more
as an investor in both of those companies, I should say.
Yeah. And I am not an investor in those companies. I still am a bit long on WWE up until we see what these rates are going to be. I think I've been on that one throughout the year. And. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then Brandon, I presented the question last week in the Super Chat. As an investor, do you want to see Amazon continue to invest billions of dollars in a loss-leading part of their business? Mm-hmm. Amazon Prime is a pretty mature business line. There's not many people now that are signing up for additional content that don't have Amazon Prime.
But I think the prices will be raised gradually over time. And I think like that's something that I've tweeted about, and I think in a joking way here and there, is that there's already this culture of my cable bill is too high. And like as a consumer, I've never really experienced that. I've never subscribed to cable. I've never done that on my own. Obviously my parents had cable, not obviously. And I think as time goes on, this luxury of being able to subscribe to Netflix for $10 or whatever it is now. I should do subscribe to Netflix, but I don't know what the price point is. But being able to subscribe to these streaming services for $10, I think is sort of a bait to get tons of consumer activity and tons of loyalty. And once you've got people hooked and essentially addicted, I think that's going to continue to increase and increase, and consumers will kick and scream and complain. There might be a lot more volatility about it because it's not tied up in a bundle. And there's one problem I think the media world is facing is that the part of the attraction to all these streaming services is the ease at which you can cancel and resubscribe. I think that is a big deal. I think that's really underrated, that friction of I don't want to go through the hassle of like having to get somebody into my house to sign up for cable and all the rigmarole that's involved in that, not to mention the actual expense that's involved in that. But streaming is so much more convenient. Not only is it cheaper, but it's also easy for me to cancel and get rid of it if I want without having to have the cable guy get into my house.
I'll give you a great example. Game of Thrones, House of Dragons ended. I canceled HBO. Mm-hmm. Yellowstone started. Yes. I got Paramount Plus. Mm-hmm. And I will continue to do that until they stop it and figure out a way to make me be a subscriber. Like Amazon Prime got me, right? Because I wanted to watch Thursday Night Football. I'm in for the year. ESPN,
and you don't subscribe to Amazon Prime year-round?
I do now because it's an annual subscription.
It's an annual subscription now?
The one that I ended up stuck with after the free trial, yes.
Yes.
But again, I tried for the free trial.
Andy Jassy, I.
The other thing is we're looking at ESPN now putting in price increases for the first time. And we're going to see how that affects its subscriber base. Netflix went a very long time without increasing prices. They went a very long time without cracking down on sharing. And the idea was that they just wanted to, like you said, get people addicted. You know, we think about a lot of companies, and if you move outside the media space, they were giving away tons of value and services for cheap because they were trying to disrupt. Uber rides cheaper than taxis on your phone. At some point, they have to raise prices. And we're going to see that now.
I feel like Uber is there. I mean,
they're there now.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And there are other companies.
Uber used to be a great deal. Lyft used to be a great deal. And now it's like,
it's a cab.
Yeah. But it's just a convenient way to get it rather than like, I got to hail one down or call somebody.
Bingo. So let's turn this back to media. Will streaming be an easy way to keep watching shows you always watched on cable? Right, so is the idea that we're going to take these properties, throw them on streaming, and people are going to go to streaming? I've always viewed companies that come to market with easier ways to do things, we call those the disruptors, and they disrupt the existing way. And now, even though Uber has raised their prices, I'm always using Uber because it's on my phone. It's so easy. I can't imagine life without it. Mm-hmm. I think about this for WWE going to Amazon. Am I logging into Amazon on a Monday night to watch WWE when my historical pattern has been to watch it on cable, hit the last button, go to ESPN to watch the football game, maybe check into what's going on with the news if there's a big event, but then I can flip back to the main event of Raw. All of a sudden, the consumer behavior...
So you're talking about like friction in particular, but like, is it that much... is it more friction to like... I've watched Thursday Night Football. I put it on at least. And I felt like it was pretty easy for me to. I have an Apple TV, you know, connected to the TV, and they make it very clear because it's the big live event that's happening right now. As soon as you turn on that Amazon Prime Video app, that there's a big NFL graphic or whatever, and you just hit it live. Is it that much friction?
Well, can you jump to another station if you want to watch something during a commercial?
No, but is that. Is that something that people still do? Like, I used to do that as a kid. And we used to have like, you know, a TV remote and the channels would flip. And I know people, I think the alternative to that now is like people browsing through the guide, right? And I know like there's a lot of systems that have like the guide with the picture in the guide. So you can see what's on the TV as you browse through the guide. Is that such an important part of the consumer behavior that, I don't know, it significantly changes the game? I don't know.
Well, to me, a lot of what the consumer behavior is right now with television and why sports rights are said to be so, you know, bulletproof, so to speak, is that that's what draws eyeballs. It's appointment viewing. Thursday night, as you've pointed out, Amazon owns Thursday night with Thursday Night Football now. We've seen it with the WWE on Peacock that it has a great viewership for premium live events. The question I have is, regular season NBA, regular season hockey, Monday Night Raw. Are these things that are appointment viewing? And are these things that people are going to go seek out on a platform that is not where they traditionally consumed it, nor is it easy enough to kind of view it passively or have things like we're talking about flip back and forth? So I think there's some risk there for the properties to go after the big offers from these tech companies. And I think there's some reconsiderations that may take place about going after them when it comes to how profitable.
Have you seen the Thursday Night Football ratings?
Yeah, they're fantastic.
Yeah. And that's really encouraging me to say, I mean, you probably heard me say it, that, look, this is a show that is doing nearly as well on streaming as it was doing on traditional TV. Now, that wouldn't have been the case a few years ago, and streaming was not embraced enough at that point, and cable, you know, conversely, was not diminished enough at that point. But that's really encouraged me to start to make the case that WWE and Amazon could have a really plausible discussion about having either Raw or SmackDown on Amazon Prime Video. Gully, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah, I have a question here. You know, we're talking about a recession and a bubble burst.
He had the Gully, I want to jump in face. I've learned to read it.
I think the question for me would be like, you know, we're talking about bubble bursts. What about these streaming services just either merging or just going under because oversaturation does happen? I mean, we're going to lose HBO Max. It's going to merge with Discovery Plus. I would assume that's the assumption. We don't know what's – and who knows how really – what I mean, Peacock's not doing great. Paramount Plus, they're not doing great compared to, you know, the other streaming services. So does that maybe make the sports rights, you know, maybe not decrease but not have a huge increase because there's going to be less competition because somebody like Amazon might now be, you know – sitting pretty because they have less streaming services that can compete or less networks that NBC Universal and Warner Bros. Discovery. We heard that rumblings. I mean,
speculating here, I do believe there will be consolidation in this space. I think it may actually help kind of backstop the value of these because at that point now is the only place to get it. We see the NBA coming up on their renewal. It'll be very interesting to see whether they spread their rights out across multiple parties, and is that the way that they retain the value or get an increase? But I think consolidation is inevitable. I mean, some of these are losing billions of dollars now, and I don't know what the path to profitability is. You see an activist investor go to Disney and say, hey, maybe spin out an ESPN. And they do that because they're looking at Disney's core businesses and other potential business lines and things that they can get into and saying, okay, is ESPN a drag? Granted, ESPN is a big part of the Disney, I'll call it the cable bundle offering. But again, it goes back to that question of how much do you want to keep spending if you're not able to actually turn it into a profitable business line? And the one thing I'll just go back on, recession is a little bit different than what I'm suggesting. We may go through a recession. It may be deep. It may be shallow. It'll affect consumers, affect certain parts of the economy. The interest rates, to me, are key. All of these streamers did this, did their launches and raced to market during 2020 and 2021. Again, when the ability to get capital was very cheap. And we've not seen interest rates back up around 4 or 5% in many years. And if you go back to, I think, the 90s or so, it was around 7%. And we saw a lot of tech companies try to get really big really fast. It didn't work out. So that's where I think about it. And it's a little different than a recession, just because the recession will play out in the zero interest rate environment may not come back, which changes the calculus of these businesses.
So the next big TV rights deals that are coming up are AEW, actually in this order, WWE, AEW. I think UFC will come up before the NBA and then the NBA. What do you think WWE gets? Is 1.5x a good base case? Higher or lower?
I've gone 360 on this. At the start of the year, I did believe that there was a lot of value in the company. I think now it's probably realized. I think the base case...
And you're still, you're long on WWE right now?
I'm still a bit long on it, yes. Okay. Looking into early 2023 with some positions. Because I am now back on the case, the bear case. Are they going to get a 1.5 increase? And I think that 1.5 increase that's been put out there is now baked into the stock price. I also think it was done at a time that there wasn't as much visibility into what was happening to these companies. If you look at the layoffs taking place at Amazon and Apple, these are not seasonal layoffs. 10,000 people as Amazon is the largest corporate layoffs I believe they've done. You see what's going on with Disney, and you see what's going on with their stock price. Again, I'm referring to stock prices here because to the degree that companies are beholden to investor bases, that I think will drive some of the decisions going forward. If the base case is 1.5 and they come in slightly below it, I think it's not going to surprise me at all. I think they'll retain the value, if not see a slight increase over the current, because they're going to package in the next day rights.
Right.
So you're getting more for a little bit more of a price, but you know, net-net, is it really the increase that everyone's expecting or looking for? I think UFC and AEW are unique positions also because they provide a pay-per-view model. One of the things I've been considering is whether or not somebody wants to get in business with WWE, bring them onto the streaming, and then spend all the weekly television time advertising premium events on another network. I find that to be a bit of a conflict. Right, is Amazon going to say on Monday Night Raw or on Thursday or Friday SmackDown, hey, go subscribe to Peacock to watch the premium event? Doesn't make much sense to me. It's not that they may not do that. And maybe Peacock wants to get out of the deal and they want to sell the whole thing off. We've seen different...
It's not exactly the same. Yeah. Is that a lot different than the NFL has every TV partner? And the NBA has ESPN and WBD. MLB is on ESPN and Turner, WBD. Is that it's not quite the same as like build peak event, but it's definitely and you, I think you do even hear, right? Like I've seen this season NFL games being promoted on a given network that are being aired on a different network.
I don't know about like regular season, but they do that for the playoffs for sure. So, like, if you watch playoff game on CBS, you'd be like, oh, later tonight on Fox will be, you know, the Eagles and the Giants or whatever. Like, you see that on playoffs. I don't know. I'll pay attention today. I don't know if you hear them, see that much regular season.
You've seen them do the Nickelodeon experience where they put it on for the kids. They do cross-promote, but that's always been the case, and it's never been the case where you are cross-promoting to somebody that is a direct competition to your subscribers. Right, so if you have CBS, you have Fox. If you have cable, you have the rest of the networks. Now I'm paying whatever I'm paying for Amazon Prime, but they're telling me to go pay money to Peacock. I think that's just a different dynamic here than what we've all lived with for the last however many years with cable. And as far as the pay-per-view stuff, my understanding is BR Live or whoever AEW is doing their pay-per-view streaming from, but mostly BR Live, I believe, in their partnership.
In the U.S., it's BR Live. Internationally, Fight. And for the first time, there was some YouTube distribution, too, of pay-per-view for this pay-per-view.
And UFC has proved to be very successful for ESPN Plus in being able to upsell. And that, to me, is a bit of an advantage for UFC. And I think will be useful for AEW, the ability to provide that upsell that they've now conditioned an audience to, you know, we've seen this year, maybe not as good compared to last year with the Punk pay-per-views, but consistently doing good numbers. And that to me is something that'll be a bit beneficial for them, especially coming in with a lower probably price point than WWE is for their renewal.
Yeah. I think there's, even if, let's just assume that there's a weak market generally for TV rights fees, which isn't the case right now. Every deal that I'm aware of has been an increase, at least on like a per hour basis, per game basis, however you want to put it. And when I say every, I guess going back at least the last several years. I know there was one MLB deal that was lower, but it was for fewer games. So generally, it's everybody's getting a raise still. I think even if we enter a world, and it would have to start happening pretty soon, where TV rights aren't just automatically getting an increase. AEW is in a more nascent position in 2020 than it is today. It was less proven then in January 2020 when it signed its current deal than it is today. It is, when you compare it to the leading wrestling content, which is WWE, Raw and SmackDown, on a per hour basis, on the rate at which they deliver viewers, AEW is way undervalued. So I think you could even if the bubble bursts, worst case scenario, it seems pretty likely to me, even against some massive headwind like that, that AEW would still get an increase. I always want to point out to the WWE and AEW warriors who may be listening that would still mean that AEW would be making less TV money than WWE because WWE is just so far ahead currently. But yeah, I think WWE is, or AEW is in a particularly likely situation just because they are a newer and more or less proven property in the first place. But yeah, the argument that I've made to you, MJ, is that I think there's, even if there are these sort of problems with the suitors, with the buyers, even if their businesses are really having problems and they don't have the money to make great offers on this content, the fact that these most popular shows are not just a little bit more popular than the next tier down, but they are extremely more popular than the next tier down. So that I think as long as they're able to aggregate as many eyeballs as they do, to the extreme rate at which they do, let's say the top 10. And I was trying to, as you were talking, to find an Excel spreadsheet that would quickly show a chart that would illustrate this. But I will draw it with my finger for people watching on YouTube. It's an exponential trend where you have the top 10 or 20 shows that are like a straight up line, and then everybody else is way down on this curve where there's not a lot of differentiation. So in this top, I don't know, 5% or something like that, there's an extreme concentration of value. And I have to think that, and maybe this is me over-relying on data, maybe, that there's, as long as there's that extreme disparity in the top 10 or 20 shows, there's going to be an extreme disparity in the value. I guess the argument against that is that, well, everybody's value is going to fall. And so they could still be extremely more valuable than the rest of them, but still be, but still lose value. But I guess I think in the broader media economy, there's that exponentiality will continue to be more exacerbated. The extremeness of that curve, of that exponential curve, is only likely to become more extreme as media continues to fragment, as the entertainment options continue to increase, whether that's gaming, whether that's streaming, whether that's traditional TV still existing, whether that's people watching WrestleNomics Radio on YouTube. There's just an endless supply of entertainment options that are continuing to create harder and harder competition for everybody so that the biggest winners, I think, continue to have the biggest value that the distributors will have to pay an extreme premium to have.
And do you think that translates to streaming as an option?
Yes, because I think this, I want to say, luxury that we all have in paying $10 or $12 per month for streaming is a fading phenomenon. And everybody's going to kick and scream about it, just like they've kicked and screamed about their cable. but they'll continue to pay it, or enough of them will continue to pay it so that these media companies are able to get the profitability off of this content that they ultimately want. The challenge is, how does this friction play out? And do there end up being, like we saw at the very beginning of the W Network, these 6-month commitments or something like that? And I think you will see cracking down on account sharing and things like that.
And what it'll be very interesting to watch, and pardon me as I did not do my research on this next point that I should have, what is the incremental increase to Amazon Prime subs because they now have Thursday Night Football?
Yeah, it's probably not a lot, right? Are there other values that they're getting out of that? Is it data? Is it the ability to market to those people who are watching and get them to spend money on retail?
To the degree that the e-commerce business is not necessarily the revenue driver that it's made out to be, or it's starting to slip a little bit, you know, I question what that the marginal increase is, or the benefit being driven is. If you tell me that,
and maybe part of that is like maybe there isn't a clear strategy in those offices, like the notion that they want to collect all of this time spend, people's time engaged with the content, is the assumption is that, you know, eventually, as our teacher George Berrios taught us, the money will follow the eyeballs and we'll monetize it in some way that will be profitable.
Sure. And we have to see these streamers evolve more. I mean, Amazon Video, Amazon Prime Video, they call it?
Yes.
So I'm new to that. So they did get me as a marginal increase. It's been around for a while. I don't know how much it grows year over year. I think the other platforms, Paramount Plus, Peacock, Disney Plus, HBO Max, which will become the Discovery HBO combination.
Yes.
It'll be interesting to see how much they continue to grow year over year. Netflix has now hit that point of kind of stagnation, plateau. They'll be up or down based on what content they have. Like you said, will they be able to keep people locked in for a longer period of time? Perhaps, and I think that is their strategy, but they'll also offer a cheaper alternative and then rely on the advertising market. Now, if cable itself can't last the test of time just based on consumer behavior in the advertising market, right? We see the slow decline in cable trends, and I won't go as far to say cable's going to die, but obviously not the business it once was.
Well, we'll try to get Rich Greenfield on another day.
Is it prudent for these companies to go chase a strategy that is reliant on advertising and consumer behavior to keep spending more and more and more year over year on the properties? I don't pretend to be that I have every answer. I know this to be true. I just think about it through these lenses, which I think is different than the average sports rights only go up. Because at one point you could have said a lot of things only go up until they don't. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm looking at as the environment changes. Again, different than a recession, but recessions change consumer behaviors. Maybe you don't need 6 streamers, and you come out of 2023 and you say, you know what, these two are good enough for me. And then there's always the way that people get around watching other different, through other means.
Yeah. Okay, it's just about 1 o'clock, so I think we need to release the Buffalo Bills fans to go watch the Buffalo Bills. But yeah, I think it would be interesting to see when, say, TV, pay TV gets down to like 60 million, because then it's really in the realm of what, say, Netflix is doing in the U.S., if that changes the economics in some interesting way. But anyway, we'll wrap up. I just want to say quickly, you know, I spent a lot of the afternoon at QXT's nightclub, and I know MJ, you were there too. And we visited with many people for the post wrestling 5-year anniversary. Robert Pearson did a great job setting it up and providing a great backstage area with seltzer and lots of other stuff. It was catered.
I'd like to plug his company, Real Digital.
Yes.
They do great work, and Robert has been a great member of the community.
He did the WrestleNomics mug design.
Yes.
So it was really great to meet everybody and to talk to everybody in person. You know, people that you know online for years, and to meet them in person finally. So then that was a great time. And not just that, but just like this whole weekend of I met Lavi. We had breakfast.
I saw the picture.
Yes. Yes. I met Dr. Chris Ely. I met MJ from NJ and lots of other people. So it's been a really nice time. And the post event in particular is a great highlighting of the great community of people that they put together. Anything else to add to that?
These weekends are always a lot of fun whenever we get together. I came up really last
year. As a post-wrestling OG.
As a post-wrestling OG, but also just as a member of the wrestling community and wrestling world. I've gone to a few different events in the last 2 years, and they're always a great communal experience with the AEW crowds. I will say, warm weather markets, because I feel there's a lot better energy and a lot better...
This would have been better if it wasn't free. It was very cold in New York as well, and New Jersey. No snow, though. No snow. All right. We'll let everybody go. Thanks for listening. I have a Patreon. There's a WrestleNomics Patreon, patreon.com/WrestleNomics. You can get my TV ratings reports and a lot of other information there for just $5 a month. Anything to plug, all?
Just a big wrestling week for me. Wednesday night before Thanksgiving, I'll be ring announcing Revenge Pro Wrestling. Friday after Thanksgiving, I'll be ring announcing ESW Wrestle Bash. And then the Sunday evening BCW, I'll be debuting a new interview segment. But I'm also a heel manager there, so it's like a Piper's Pit type thing. So,
yeah. Anything you want to plug, MJ?
Never anything to sell. Go follow the post-wrestling group. Go follow WrestleNomics. Obviously, you're already doing that. I really value and respect the work that both groups put out. It was great to be with everyone, like you said.
Okay. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time.